very, very short section of a story I've read, some of the other pieces that the last couple of weeks. But now to the music. Let's try and separate it from all your first. When I got back to Oldenburg, I slipped right back into German life, worked hard at university, and Cork and Onya fell away. Now, I haven't had so many sexual partners in my life to pretend that I forgot her or that she couldn't have made any lasting impression on me. All the same, what emerged with force into my life while Onya and Cork faded was Mendelssohn's music. Naturally enough, I got the violin concerto first and listened to that almost every night for 6 months. After that, I started exploring the symphonies, and just when I thought I had almost exhausted the fascination, that I was glimpsing the limits of Mendelssohn's genius, I heard the Midsummer Night's Dream overture, and then there were the other overtures and the songs without words and the octet, which seemed to me for a long time to be the most special piece of all, maybe even the happiest piece of music ever written. When people asked me back then if I liked classical music, I would say I didn't know. All I knew was that I liked Mendelssohn. When one girl I dated asked me if that wasn't a bit obsessive, I happily conceded that it was. It was nothing new for me. Obsession and single-mindedness were my way of dealing with the world since I was a boy, whether it was collecting Panini stickers or making highly elaborate model aeroplanes. All the same, I branched out and listened to other composers too, and the whole experience was very rewarding. I studied very hard and listened to lots of music, and my life was very full. If my love of classical music was born in Ireland, it turns out that my taste was robustly German. Bach, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Schumann, and Brahms. And later, when I read my first biography of Mendelssohn, I was gratified to learn that his taste was almost exclusively German too. Often I wondered whether it was the Germanness of Mendelssohn's music that called out to me in my Cork solitude. Could it have been essentially homesickness that attracted me to the music? Could the special clarity that Onya and the Frenchman found in the music have tapped even deeper into my German heart? Is it possible that his music embodied an essentially German intellectual universe, a Geisteswelt, that survived even the middle decades of the 20th century and was shared by me? I'll leave it there.
We're getting a lot of prose recently. Paul Casey said to me last week, and here we are, two readers, and we're on prose. But whoever's next better have poetry.
Well, they're going out the window.
No, they're going out the window. So I read this.
The rest of us are just amateurs.
I read the start of this last week, so I'm just going to try and finish tonight. So just for those of you who weren't here, or maybe those of you who've forgotten, or maybe those of you who didn't listen to the MP3, just a quick, the main character is Jim. He's in New York. He's been there for a fortnight hanging around also a bookshop, staring at a man who's working in the bookshop, an old man who's an ex-teacher of his, and we've established that he's had a difficult life. Jim understood the part procrastination and fear and had played in his life very well now. That understanding had been a large part of his growth, but he understood too that time was pressing. Tomorrow was the end of the line. Tomorrow his ticket expired and the journey home was to hand. Home, where so much he had considered beyond him, love, children, work, a future, waited. Home, where Sharon, who through a phone light had cajoled him through the disappointment of not crossing this threshold every night, passed her time praying he would make it. Jim focused again on the shop. The old man was looking his way. Jim began to shake, fixed his eyes to the ground, took a deep breath, counted to five in his head, exhaled. Just breathe. That's all you have to do. The stress leaves. It will. He was as stressed now, he knew, as he had been for a long time. He could feel from the rapid beat of his heart, the sweat on his palms, the swirling in his head. But he was still certain that the vision of the old man, my old teacher, he corrected again, exiting the shop and marching towards him was not real. He knew because this image, the one with Mr. Drew wearing brown cords, a red shirt and a gruff look, just as he had been on the day Jim had plucked up the courage to tell him he had been assaulted, had confronted him regularly over the years. Jim reminded himself that despite this image materialising before him on street corners, when he opened doors, when he closed his eyes, when he had too much or not enough to drink over the years, he had survived. He reminded himself that the frequency with which the image had appeared slowly diminished. And he reminded himself that he had not only survived, but that he had thrived. Keep telling yourself that, his therapist had said to him on almost every visit. And Jim had. In fact, it was those words that allowed Jim to find the strength to begin looking for his old teacher. Those words that had helped him believe that he could and would one day face the man he believed for so long with the source of every ounce of misery to enter to enter his and his mother's lives. And it was those words that kept him going when the pain of revisiting his past had threatened to overwhelm him. That pain had been evident from the first moment of this journey, when, after a gap of 20 years, Jim had stepped through the school entrance and the Gargaritan authority vested in builders of future generations had compressed on him like a giant, collapsing vat. Jim had run that day. Out into the spring air he had fled before, while recanting his therapist's words and refusing to bulge the fear the image of Mr. Drew's steely, sceptical eyes instilled in every molecule of his being, he had forced his legs to carry him back through the oak doors, and his eyes, his child's eyes, took in the punitive surroundings once more. Jim understood now those child's eyes, and erroneous, deep-rooted perceptions invited to pass forth, that connections made in parts of his mind he did not understand but could control had led him on a path where bounty came in the shape of self-loathing, depression and worthlessness. That understanding had been another major breakthrough. In fact, that had been the turning point. Only then could memories of too many boys in one place, flesh against flesh, hands in his trousers and harsh beagles peeling like an oscillating echo be confronted. As the breathing exercise he'd been practicing for 15 years brought his shaking under control, Jim focused on the one yellow eye of the unrewardable cat and mumbled his affirmations. The passers-by faded, became sable, wraith-like entities floating in a grey tar, and the strength of those words filled him. As always, the words provided a better high than any of the substance he'd abused, and tingling at the memories, Jim reran each of his hard-won victories. As he did, he allowed the images to flow through him, bereft of the emotions that had anchored him for so long. He thought of the pristine sanitarium, the first institution he had been consigned to. He heard the 10 o'clock chime that signaled the end of the day, and the death breathing, those long, greedy, wet slobs that had filled the night air and his head for years afterwards. Then he was back in the squat, the dank and dingy den of iniquity that he had stumbled into not long after escaping the sanatorium and had called home for 7 years. Jim allowed party marks, leering smile and wild, frantic eyes raised before him. Waited for the knife to appear above his head. This had been a tough memory to revisit, but he had done it. And now, with the New York sun beating on his head and his old teacher in sight, Jim heard Mark hiss the words that for so long had filled his heart with fear and regret. Time to go, quiet man. Time to go. And let him know.
Love the prose, but it's with great hope that our next reader has a poem for us. Mary, is it prose or is it poetry?
It's poetry.
Poetry. Yeah.
Good boy.
Thanks, Stanley.
So one day I was walking along the road and I saw what I didn't know what it was, but it turned out, well, you'll find out in the poem. It's called Falling Out. Roadkill on the tarmac. A flattened squirrel. As I draw near, I see it plainly now. A mislaid glove. Dropped, no doubt, in haste, as its owner left his car. Caramel suede, an inner hint of fur, an object without feeling, yet my ripe imagination slips in to take a hand in its abandoned state. Imagines how it was before the fall. When snug beside its mate, it nestled in some hall-stand drawer. They must have been quite a pair, going everywhere in tandem, nothing they couldn't handle as long as both were there. Now, severed from togetherness, an outcast on the verge, cut down in its prime before it might lose its lustre, get stained or start to fray, it lies deflated without the feel of flesh. Hollow where once the pulse of blood was felt, where fingers found their place, its single state makes it unfit to carry on or carry anything, a sudden end through simply losing touch. That's it.
Richie King, do you have a poem for us?
I do.
You got a poem?
Two all now, is that the count? This one is called Can I Hear You Listening. When I talk, do you listen? When I speak, do you care? When I need to be heard, have you heard what I need? I want you to listen to yourself, that inner voice that speaks in whispers you so often ignore. I want you to care about what you have to say. I want you to hear your own voice. I want you to read what is written between the lines. I want you to feel what you feel and ask, why do I feel this way? I want you to know yourself, to take your own power, be your own voice, be your own person, standing for something. Don't waste away into the anonymity of average, fading out for nothing. Being yourself is all you need to be. But to be your true self, you need to know your true self. Do you know what you want? Or is all this just about what I want for you? In truth, I want nothing from you. I want you to look in and listen. Listen to those whispers.
A warm welcome for Rab Urquhart.
I don't get asked if I'm doing poetry or prose. Discrimination. What? This book is by a guy called Italo Calvino, who I'm sure you've all heard of, and if you haven't heard of him, you should be ashamed of yourself.
We have now.
I was thinking about reading this, and I've done a bit of Shakespeare, and in Romeo and Juliet, there's a character called Mercutio. Calvino was asked which character from a novel or work of fiction he'd like to be, and he replied, "I would like to be Mercutio. I would like to be Mercutio. Among his virtues, I admire above all his lightness. In a world full of brutality, his dreaming imagination as the poet of Queen Mab, and at the same time his wisdom as the voice of reason amid the fanatical hatreds of Capulets and Montagues, he sticks to the old code of chivalry at the price of his life, perhaps just for the sake of style, and yet he's a modern man, sceptical and ironic, a Don Quixote who knows very well what dreams are and what reality is, and he lives both with open eyes."
Wow. Next is Patricia Watts.
Yep. Thank you, Stephen. Fair madman of the backyard. Fair madman of the backyard. You are traveler with my mumbles in student rock letters. Come tumble to my night time and fool me in daring I would long since disowned. And plough back into my pennings the wise critics acclaim they said it fall short of. Come fuel my fractured brain, fair madman, badman of the elite class. Come over to the backyard where the new year is careering and its tears are falling cold. To the rapture of the, my yearning, kiss me deeply for the rain. Thanks.
Thanks, Patricia. Charles Clark.
I lived in Kanturk, County Cork, two very short periods in my early life, and I've written a few bits and pieces about it in this moment. Views near Kanturk. The mill house with guinea fowl and turkeys. Sorry, that's wrong. The yard with guinea fowl and turkeys. The mill house sloping to the front door. Over the stream and up to the gate lodge, there feathery arching branches made a stage for youthful role playing. A glimpse of the house with the hall haw, the British Legion cottages, brick and roses, an old gate opening on a field, thorn topland, desolate as battlefields.
Charles, that's good. Jamie, I don't know your second name. Jamie's good name.
This is a dream that I had that I wrote on. I had a dream about over 40 years ago, so it's quite an old one. But, it's called Caught in the Cogs. Walking in green hills, rolling, gently undulating, grow quickly, surprising, revolving green wheels with cogs, teeth engaged teeth like destinies meeting, uncomprehending, I'm caught by innocent flap of clothing, apprehended by teeth's opposing cycles, pinned down to the round ground, by a shoulder blade. What a turn of events. Coming towards me, slow but sure, a black man wearing shades, driving a steamroller. The situation has implications wide and flat. I panic, swiveling to left and right. The engine's revolving drum looms down like a final curtain or shutter falling. Then silence. Peaceful black with nothing to put a finger on.
The next reader wrote this piece when he was 18 years old, so he would not like to be judged for the contents of this piece, Michael Ray. Michael O'Callaghan.
Nice.
Michael Ray.
Because this showed up during the week, I was throwing out some old books. This folder in the back. 1980, in the courtyard. Like a fugitive, I waited all the night to see your window cast its path of yellow light across the cobblestones. The rain that lashed the dark had numbed all reason from my heart and told my restless blood its fever had gone cold. But when the courtyard silences of dawn appeared, and when the rains had left, your image in my heart still persevered. The rains could not disperse it, and as morning cleared, I rose like silence through your halls and corridors, past sleeping sentinels beside their sleeping dogs, down rooms conversing with the morning's empty light, and came at last to find you restless, firm and almost real in my embrace. You told me later that my feet had passed like shadows through your dreams, like voices from another world, and that the story of my entrance at your door was of a king who came to take his captured queen away and bear her to the mansion of her dreams.
Fantastic Freddie. Michael Ray couldn't have written that note at all. That was only other Michael Fallon. The next reader, Tink, his name is Padraig. Is it Padraig Collins?
Yeah.
Padraig Collins.
I wrote this last year. I was studying JJD's Politics and Society, a book you wrote in Ireland. So it's kind of a synopsis of each of the chapters. So, one, romantic bombshell. Romantic Ireland comes to a fore, a secret organisation of brothers, romantics, those who believed in change in time of it, the voice of language, labour, literature and love. It was far from militant, it was romantic. No more to do with fighting, but more to forge identity, a nation's identity, a romantic identity. A nation's identity would be forged that Easter, but not how the Brotherhood had envisaged. If they could only see today, turning and turning, they would be out of touch with the voice of language, labour, literature and love, and more in touch with greed, guilt, grief and gluttony. Yes, a bombshell, but it was seen and predicted. Yeats was right, you know. Two. Inheritance. Whittled away like everything else. No planning, not a care in the world. Excuses were made, events took place. But business as usual here. 10 years, no change, just a congress of priests running around Phoenix Park. Madness and still nothing. Only one real act of significance. A huge step forward, but not for those in power. An oxymoron? Well, yes. At the same time, it showed somehow acted as consolidation. Barrels in the breast pockets, just in case, only an era. Three. Benevolence. The plains of the Midlands brought rangers to Phoenix Park. The only mountains with a road straight through them, peat, turf and bog. Sean could cycle. He was the only one who could. Himself priests and doctors, no rubber, no tea, no sugar. A nation of tea drinkers with no tea. Surely they would never go against the grain. Your country needs you to do absolutely nothing. Heads down and follow the leader, we are good at that. All would be fine as long as we did not trouble the troublemakers on the continent. The weather and the firemen helped us through, and Hempel couldn't make head nor tail of us. In a time of war, you'd think something might happen here, but we are content and happy to paint rocks with our names on them. A time where the rest of the continent saw catastrophe, we painted rocks. Surely it was only us who could pull such a stroke. Be on both sides at once, but on no side at all. Only we could envisage tourists in a time of war, extract whatever money they had left by setting up a tourist board. Impeccable timing, wouldn't you say? Devil era.
One and a half.
One heavy line, one light dot. Okay? So the heavy line bit is now. It's 1990 seat. The line of Babylon. A coat is gnarled, its features gnawn, its desert winds of sandy blasts. Dim, reamed eyes have watched his citadel for 3,000 years, and still he sees through depths of pass. His sentries now wear shabby armour, acrylic jumpers holed and frayed over dish dash, or Farrah crimping slacks. The only gold that gilts borders is for rotting jagged teeth, breathing frankincense of garlic breath and cheap cigarette plumes. Hey, you Irish coffees, with the chocolate legs of the tan lime cream toffee. Pull from frisking clamping clutches, this worn proud head holds still for us to pass. No shame is sought, far worse was wrought. He leads a long approach to Ishtar's gate, the goddess too had seen her share of love shorn and torn. And here at the party of the tigers in the Euphrates waters stands the midwife to the birth of law and constitution, presumption of innocence deciphered in cuneiform stones, who may be enshrined in evidence to protect all parties' rights. Amorites, Assyrians, Persians and Greeks all seize the lion. None of all this plunder compares to the bulldozer's teeth. Vanity palace squats and artifacts, Saddam's autograph on every brick, aping Sumerian kings, stars of striped bricks, soldiers thieving mine dragon stones from gates, Gates bones. Babel now is raised to its lowly 22 metres at Peter's. Helipads built, vast pavements crushed to overfilled on this blame game. So the line of Babylon is defanged and crowned, his mane is shorn and now is worn in shame, but still he sees through dimming eyes as yet his fourth millennium arrives. So, short last one now. The canine concubine, it's our visiting dog. There's romance on the menu today. The ancient corgi cruise ship has arrived. She's also very free with her favours. Her doggy bows need a lot of drive. There's one abeam full of steam, bearing straight ahead. And there's one astern whose heart so yearns for his heaven in her bed. A 14-year-old granda and his silly son will have the fun till the set of sun. One's not able, the other knows not how. She's not too keen for their seed anyhow. Once my car ventures out the drive, their daycare lover, live-in lover, contrives to brighten up their dog day afternoons and leave them howling at the moon.
There's one last name on the list. I don't know if he's going to have a poem or a short, but Connor McManus. What's up, please? Poem or short? Short, it's a short.
Thanks, Stephen. I don't know how to do it. Really good. I have a serious difficulty with introductions, really. I don't really know what to say, whether I should give an introduction or not, and I've been debating it. So I've decided I'm not going to give an introduction. Take, for instance, if I said I was from Leitrim, people might laugh. And if I said I was from Drumshambo, they might laugh even harder. Leitrim is neither north nor west. It's not Donegal and it's not Roscommon. A place nobody knows except dubs who come for the weekend on boats, or English bucks coming to fish. The captain says things like, it would knock far from a snipe to pull a blade of grass in Leitrim, and Leitrim land is measured by the gallon that's that wet. And every Leitrim crow carries a packed lunch. Some people might laugh a nervous laugh because Leitrim men are thin on the ground, and they never met one before. And maybe there's no such thing as a Leitrim man anyway, who knows? Weights and Measure says being a Leitrim man is an aspirational construct, wherever he got that one. I was telling the captain that Weights and Measure, what Weights and Measure said, and he said he might be right, that he, the captain, was the last true blue Leitrim man. He was born in Church Street around the time of the bank robberies. Everyone that came after was born in Roscommon Hospital. That's where I was born, and they closed that. So now all Leitrim men are born in Sligo, except the hippies and the blow-ins, who have their babies at home and breastfeed in the toilets. They're all Leitrim men now too, I suppose. Leitrim men are no good at hurling, that's true. And we amalgamated with Roscommon and Longford, who are no good either. But we got to the Connacht final in 1957 playing football, and the captain still talks about it. He says, McGarty was a giant, but I know the captain could come out with anything. Like the time he said he fought shoulder to shoulder with John Wayne and Davy Crockett at Dalamo, and only for him. You wouldn't know what to believe half the time, so you wouldn't. Leitrim has only 4 miles of coastline, and most people think Larry Cunningham is a Leitrim man, but he isn't. I just thought I'd throw that in there for the sake of it. Drumshambo is nestled at the foot of Slieven Éireann, where the two-headed Danny came down in the mists of time, and fought a great battle with the Formorians down around Sligo somewhere. That's what the brochure says, but that's a while ago now. Now and again, the odd French cyclist gone astray would park his laden bike against our wall looking for something to eat, or a cup of coffee, and he'd have a search on his hands. There wasn't a lot to eat in our town. roasted chicken from our spit, or chips or a cone from Eta's sweet shop on the Carrick Road corner. Mrs. Bruin up at the convent cooked chips in her kitchen, and you'd have to knock on her front door and wait in her hallway while she heated the oil. She wore her hair up in a bun on the top of her head, and all I remember about her is the hair clips. For some reason, there was nothing worse than waiting in Mrs. Bruin's hallway with the rain pouring down outside and the lights flickering on in the street. And nobody even knows for sure what Drumshambo means. The master says it's the ridge of the old huts, but Weights and Measures says it's the back of the old cow. But it's hard to believe Weights and Measures all the time. The captain says he got kicked out of the seminary and his butt is as sharp as a tack, but added from the solid dint of drink. But Drumshambo people don't seem to think it's a bit funny. To them, Drumshambo is just Drumshambo, home to Pascal Mooney and Bo Peep Jam. People listen to Pascal Mooney in Ballyfin, County Leash, and eat Bo Peep Jam in Saudi Arabia where they put salt in their coke. The big field behind the jam factory is where the French camped on the way to defeat at Ballinamuck, and where the captain met Matt Busby when he touched down in his helicopter for juice. Not only that, Drumshambo is a town of three churches and three butchers, a river, the Bog of Mash, a hall that was once a ballroom, a frozen food factory that was once the Roxy Cinema where the captain learned all he knows about Al Capone, and a dance hall that they came from all over too, and you wouldn't get your nose through the jamb of the door on New Year's Eve with Big Tom playing. It is a high street and a low street like no other town in the country. Had a train station, a mill that produced electric light before other towns, and has a well for water that the frogs spawn in. It had a handball alley too, but they'd done away with that to build the new school. Weights and Measures said a lad would learn more in half a day in that alley than he ever would at any desk. At the end of the high street there is a square where the bullock went berserk after catching the smell of death and broke loose from the back of Shanks, and the captain had to go for the gun. Tommy Gweehan and Joe Johnson were out that day, legs and arms akimbo, and stopped the bullock from heading up to the nuns. And the sergeant, his cap gone, stood in the square and watched as the bait with nowhere to go headed straight for the doorway of Mackey's public house, and kicked and burst before him. He flittered with kicks the timber and glass partition that formed the internal porch of Mackey's before turning back towards the street, eyes wide and wide. The captain let him have it with both barrels, bang, and the shot reverberated off the red bank, and the legs buckled under him. Weights and Measures said, a man can only believe the half of what he hears around this town. But at least the nuns never had to ring the emergency bell if they were starving, and we were proud of that. Thank you.